Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Learning Pod Network, brought to you by Impact Connections, where we'll be taking a deep dive into the new world of learning pods that are driving educational innovation around the world. I'm your host, Steve Eno. The world has been changed forever by COVID-19. Right now, families and schools around the country are trying to figure out the best way forward without much support. That is why we have created the Impact Connections Learning Pod Network. We believe small group learning, driven by family needs and supported through a network of strong relationships, can improve education for everyone in this moment and beyond. On this podcast, we'll bring you advice from innovative educators and experts to help you create the best learning pod experience possible. If you are running your own learning pod or collection of learning pods, we would love for you to join our Impact Connections Learning Pod Network. Joining our network will give you access to all of our resources to take the teaching and learning happening in your learning pod to the next level, and will open up doors to more connections and opportunities for your students. At the end of this episode, I'll explain more about the benefits and how to join. But if you would like more information now, please go to www.impactconnections.org/community. Buggy eyes, tell me what to hear. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Learning Pod Network. We have an amazing episode today where I get to dig in deep with two reading experts who have created an amazing app called Augstar Reading, and they do an amazing job answering questions that I've heard from parents about their child's reading and really explaining what we can do to help. And so our guests today are Dr. Fran Levin-Bauman and Stephanie Nislow, founders of Augstar Reading. Dr. Fran Levin-Bauman is currently director of Bauman Educational Services Incorporated and Multiflex Educational Services LLC. She is the author of Bauman's Orton-Gillingham Plus guidebook and co-author of the Model Philosophy Writing Program. She is a co-founder of Augstar Reading, a reading game app for students in grades K through 8, and was a former president of the International Dyslexia Association in Maryland, and a former vice president of the Learning Disabilities Association in Pennsylvania. Her partner, Stephanie Nislow, is currently a multisensory structured language tutor working with students in grades K through 12. She was a classroom teacher for the Baltimore County Public Schools and was nominated for Teacher of the Year. She has extensive experience tutoring students and adults in a wide range of subjects, including reading, written language, executive functioning, math, and Spanish. She has worked over the last decade with students with dyslexia, dysgraphia, dyscalculia, and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And so this episode is one of our longer episodes, but it is worth it. Please listen through the whole thing because Stephanie and Fran give amazing insights throughout the interview, and I think you'll walk away with some tools to use with your kids and ways you can make sure that they are reading at the level they should be and how you can support them. So enjoy our conversation. Welcome. So we have Fran Bauman and Stephanie Nislow joining us today, and they are the founders of Augstar Reading. And as a fellow startup, I would love to hear both of your story about how you got started and what were the challenges, like what your mission is and your goals with Augstar Reading.
Well, I was just going to say, I'm a little bit jealous because you are starting your company with a tech background and understanding of this world that we're in. So we decided to start an ed tech company, and we had the ed part down, but not so much the tech. So good for you. You've got both of those components in your wheelhouse. But I was a teacher for many years, and Fran has been in the field of education for many years. And Fran was actually my mentor, taught me the Orton-Gillingham method for working with kids who were struggling readers. And that's just revolutionized my teaching experience. And I just was blown away by it, as so many people are who are fortunate enough to have that training. And I began to work individually with kids as a tutor. And I had known Fran from that, but we also live in the same neighborhood. And so I just began to toy with the idea of meeting more kids' needs, because as I would get calls from kids who needed tutoring and they didn't fit into my schedule, I couldn't find them another tutor. I just saw that the need was so vast, and that as much as tutors want to meet these kids' needs, you know, their time is limited, student resources are limited. There are lots of students who are in schools who are not getting what they need, the kind of instruction that works for them. And so Fran had created this amazing program. I'll let her tell you about that. And I thought we should turn it into an app.
And we would be out walking our dogs because we're in the same neighborhood.
Yeah.
And she would say to me, you know, we really should turn this into an app. And I would be like, oh, Stephanie, I don't have time to make an app. It's a great idea. Maybe you should just do it. Like, I just can't fit it into my schedule. And maybe on about the sixth, seventh, eighth time, she is a persistent person, I said, okay, well, you know, let's just look into it. Oh my God. Had I known how many hours it would take to get to this point where we actually have a working product for iPad and Chromebook, maybe I should have just taken the dog inside. I don't know. But on the other hand, I love it. Yeah. I love the app. I love what it's doing, because I think Stephanie had the foresight to understand what I didn't, which was that everything was going to become an app.
Right, right.
When she said that 4 or 5 years ago, you know, when you think about the fact that there weren't apps before 11, 12 years ago, they didn't even exist. And now every company, every product, every everything, you know, every waiting room, you have to go on the app to sign up, you know? And I think I didn't have that vision. And boy, am I glad she did, because really, I think by the time we got there, there already were things out there, lots of things out there. And we had to figure out with Ogstar, how are we going to make it different? Because when a parent looks up, and I'm sure you know this as a parent who's homeschooling kids, right? Like, you look up apps for reading, there's a lot of them.
Right.
And unless you've had training, it's hard to even sift through the differences between them. And so our goal was to say, okay, like, what's out there already? Mm-hmm. And now what has to really make our app different? And I think that the things that we settled on were that it really needed to have capacity for touch. It had to have capacity for speech recognition, because most of the apps do not.
Right.
So like on Ogstar, you know, if the child is asked a response, like, what is this word? They say the word, and then they are given feedback if it's correct.
Right.
And they also are given feedback if it's not correct, in the nicest of ways, of course,
right, right.
So that they don't feel badly. And then if they're still having trouble after a couple of times, then they are retaught the word so right. that they, you know, don't just keep making the same mistakes over and over again. The other thing with the touch capacity is they are asked to write a word. They actually write on the screen, either with their fingers or with a stylus.
Right.
And that means that if they miss one letter, that letter lights up and says, okay, let's try that again. And so they, again, are guided through that. So we really felt that was important. And not that that is without challenges, you right. know. Kids have different speaking patterns. Like if you have a child with a very soft voice, mm-hmm. it's hard, you know. They have to, like any tape recorder, you know, in history, like if you don't talk loud enough, it doesn't pick up the sound.
Right.
So, you know, there are things that we have to make sure kids understand. But those two features are in there. And I think the other thing that we realized is that we wanted to follow the science of reading in a comprehensive program, because we didn't want something that was just gamified, even though it is gamified. We wanted something that would be a full-out curriculum that followed the research, like, and the research in reading science mostly began, I mean, other than a few kind of important things before this, but most of it is from 1970 moving forward.
Right.
So, you know, we're looking at research that has been tried and true. So that was the other thing I think we really wanted to put into place. And, you know, it has been quite an experience trying to work with those details. We now understand why other people didn't do that.
Right, right.
It ended up being quite complicated.
Right.
You know, like we'll have a speech recognition system that's really working. All of a sudden, the company decides they don't want that one anymore.
Right.
So there's just a lot of, you know, behind the scenes details that have been, you know, really complicated, but really worth it, because now we have families calling us from, you know, I think, are we at 32 countries now? Something like that.
We have 33 countries.
But right. The point is that we'll get calls from people, and it's, you know, quite amazing. Like some places where there are no people that are trained in the science of reading.
Right.
And so this is for them the only access.
Right.
And so that's really been enlightening, I think, to realize that there are kids in places, English speaking countries, where they just have absolutely no access. And I think the other thing that we've really seen is that a lot of our kids who were getting help at school or privately also need reinforcement. I mean, if you're a kid having problems, that means the thing you're working on is difficult for you, and you can't just do it once. Sometimes you need to do it twice or three times, you know, to really learn it.
Right.
And I see Stephanie has her hand up at five times.
Right? Four or five times.
So having something engaging that a kid can do independently without a teacher or a parent. Not that it's bad to have a teacher or parent there helping you. That's a good thing, but you don't need one.
Right.
The kid can access and do it independently. So I think that also has been interesting, because I think a lot of these kids are now getting it multiple times, and you know, that's going to contribute to their progress.
Thank you for that background. And I'd love to even go a little deeper, because I think as a parent and talking to other parents, it's really hard to tell which apps are worth it, because there's so many out there and anybody can say they're research backed. But looking at Ogstar, like I have been blown away by, again, how well it's been done. And again, I've looked through the OG methodology, and I've spent a lot of time looking through the science of learning and the research behind the reading sciences. And like I would 100% have my boys use Ogstar, but I think many parents don't take the time that I do to read the research. Like most parents are going to go on the app store, search for reading, find the top app, maybe go for the free version, maybe go for the paid version, but they don't do the research like I do. And so can you give some insights into like that process of going from the research, the OG practices and the methodology that you've created, to making that happen in the app? Because I think parents need to hear a little bit about that, and how your experience really built that app, and maybe how you went back and forth with developers, and how you made absolute sure that this app is doing the exact things that you would be doing if you were sitting in the same room as the child. And so yeah, I think that insight would really help our parents and our families realize how special OGSTAR is.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head, because that's exactly what we wanted to do, was create that as close to an experience as that tutoring one-on-one experience as possible. We wanted to replicate that as closely as we could. And Fran has been training teachers. She wrote the curriculum based on many years of her own research, having explored many, many Orton-Gillingham programs out there and traveled around to be trained in all of them. And then Fran created this amazing program, which is Orton-Gillingham based, but also includes newer research on phonological awareness, which is crucial for readers who are building that foundation. And there's also fluency practice in there. So it's a really comprehensive program. And what we saw was that with Fran's background as a trainer and mine as a tutor, we could go through each of the activities that we would do with a student sitting in the room and say, okay, how does this translate onto a screen? So, for example, phonological awareness is the understanding of how the sounds fit with the letters of the alphabet. So when you teach phonological awareness or you practice it, you do not use the alphabet letters on the screen or when you're on paper, when you're with a student. So we had to replicate activities on the screen that do not use alphabet letters, but allow students to manipulate and practice using the sounds of the letters in isolation and in words, in word bits and in syllables, so that we're getting kids comfortable with hearing and applying the sounds in the oral language so that it then translates to the written language. So we at Fran's program had 7 different phonological awareness activities. That's very unique. A lot of programs out there just work on rhyming, let's say. So because students are doing so many different things with the sounds of the letters and the words, they get this really robust background. And we try to then take that and say, okay, how can we make this into a game? We normally use pom-poms on the table or colored blocks. Okay, how does that translate to the screen? And then we made images on the screen that were manipulative. So students are actively moving things on the screen and always using their voice to, as one of the, you know, multi-sensory components to understand what they're learning.
I think when phonological awareness first came out as a thing, which was really understanding what was under the letters, like how do sounds work? And every baby in every language in the world, unless they have a very significant hearing problem and can't hear the sounds, has to deal with manipulation of sound. That's how we learn to talk.
Right.
So if a baby is just making sounds in the crib, well, one day they put the sounds together and they've made a word.
Right, right.
And usually the parent responds so excited because they said a word. Well, then they have to figure out, gee, and this is the reason we read nursery rhymes to our children and Dr. Seuss, because children like rhyming, because rhyming is, well, you take off the first sound, you keep the rest of the word, and then you put another sound in the front, and you have cat and hat,
right.
And with cat and hat, and learning how to take sounds off, how to tap out syllables in words. We know by age 3, that's one of the signs of whether or not a child is going to be phono or sound logically connected to how sounds work. Being able to tap out elephant and realize it has 3 beats. Mm-hmm. The beats are almost the music of our language. And I remember when they talked about phonological awareness might be the underpinning of phon, again, meaning sound, ix, which is where we put the letters on. And I can remember, I think the first class I ever took in phonological awareness, thinking, we're going to teach people to read without letters, without books.
Right.
Like that felt so foreign, because most parents, to your point that you made earlier, you know, most parents, like, we're going to learn how to read. We pick up a book.
Right, right.
And know that there's something under those words, mm-hmm. that understanding the cat is comprised of k, at, is not something you really think about.
Right.
And we say to kids, sound out the word. Well, sometimes the kid can't blend those sounds together without the letters. So how are they going to do it with the letters, which is more complicated? So right. I think one of the things in understanding Orton Gillingham is from the, like, 1930s. But when I had first started teaching, and I had been trained in Orton Gillingham by accident, you know, the supervising teacher I had when I did my student teachings said, oh, well, let's learn this too. I'm like, okay, whatever. I never knew like how it was going to, you know, change my life.
Right.
But I learned Orton Gillingham. It was very successful. And then when we discovered that phonological awareness was part of the science of reading, that I added it into the program, as did many of my colleagues. But some people were really hesitant. They were like, why are we messing with a good thing? Well, that's because that's how science is.
Right,
you start good and you make it better if you have real evidence, you know, behind it. Then in the 1990s, when we learned that you could actually help kids to become more fluent. Mm-hmm. And fluent means fast and accurate, but not fast at the expense of accuracy or accurate at the expense of speed. It's that you can be a fluid reader where when you read, it sounds like talking. That's
right.
Basically what fluency is. And that could be trained, that we actually had things we could do. So then, you know, I added that into Orton Gillingham Plus, which is the name of the program. The plus are those two variables. That's the name of the program that the app is based on. So I think one of the things that was hard was there was a time period where people were questioning, you know, is it better to do pure Orton Gillingham, which in and of itself has a lot of research base in it, okay? We know that synthetic phonics, putting together sounds, is way more effective, especially for children who have difficulty. But really, like in the UK, they use synthetic phonics broadly across the board, rather than learning whole words. So those reading wars between whole word people and phonics people. When I did a research paper once on it, and I think I went back 350 years of reading wars. I mean, my God. Actually, I think we won the phonics people in the year 2000 when the National Reading Panel said, nope, phonological awareness in phonics does work better than whole word. And then fast forward to brain scientists like Stanislas Dehaene, who is a French scientist, neurologist, neurological background, neuropsychological background, who looked at languages all over the world and said, it really doesn't matter which language you're in, other than sign language, of course, which is a totally visual, non-sound-based language.
Right.
Even there's some sound-based in a subtle way, because you are connecting to letters and letters have sounds. And, you know, some people using it are not fully deaf. Some of them are hearing impaired. So there's a range of how sign language is used. Sometimes it's combined with other things. But the fact is that every other language in the world, he kind of did studies all over and discovered that it was the same mechanisms in the brain, no matter what language, even right. though there were some variations, obviously. You know, some languages have lots of interesting visual characters, in the Asian languages in particular. Some of them use an alphabet like we have, but they all require first an understanding of sound and then an understanding of how letters map onto sounds, and that's called orthographic mapping, where you're actually orthography is letters, where the letters are mapping onto the sounds of the language and then forming words. And in English, like, we know that only 12% of our language is really whole word oriented, and even then it's not full out whole word oriented. Those are the sight words. They're called sight words because
right.
they're irregular. They have weird things in them, weird characters that break rules.
Right.
And
right.
really only 4% of them, it's only 4% of the language that's totally irregular. So even in that 12%, 8% have something weird, you know, right. where you take a word like comfortable. We don't say comfortable. You know, so we have to deal with that and say, what do we do with all of that? Mm-hmm. Or a word like want, where only one sound is messed up, because it should say went, mm-hmm. you know, if you look at can't, but it doesn't. So right. they've got some of those as whole words. So we knew we had to address that also in our program, because you can't just forget about those words.
Right.
They're actually very frequent. You know, was should be W-U-Z. So for parents, the most important thing is understanding that there is a way to teach most people. I mean, really most, 90%. I mean, there could be other extenuating circumstances. If a child has a visual handicap, for example, or other things like that, that we have to take into account.
Right.
But when we move beyond that, like most kids can learn how to read, and I have yet to see a child who was properly diagnosed not learn how to read. They just have to follow a very, you know, specific and particular sequence.
Thank you for that information. There's a couple things that you touched on that I would love to dig into a little bit more in terms of parents and their role, especially now during COVID-19, where either parents are taking a much more active role or they don't have any teacher interaction on a daily basis other than over Zoom in these large meetings. And so with virtual school, it's getting obviously a lot harder for parents to ensure that their kids are getting the direct instruction that they need. So a parent is afraid that maybe their child's falling behind in reading. They've heard of sight words. And so they're like, maybe if I just throw a bunch of words at my kids and they memorize them, they'll know how to read. And then they'll also maybe have heard somewhere that, oh, you just have to surround your child in books and you have to read to them all the time. And I think that gets a little bit into the reading wars in terms of phonics versus whole word. And a lot of parents just probably have never heard of it. They probably have never heard of that national study that went into place in the 90s. And so I think there's just a lot of fear and uncertainty with parents right now. And they don't know what that first step is and how to understand where their kids are in their reading or how to help them move forward. And so, like, in this very unique time, I'm curious, what would you recommend parents do to allay some of that fear? And yes, I think in a perfect world, let's get them access to these apps like OggStar. But what if they don't have access to an iPad or to an internet connection? What do they do then? And what are their best options?
So I think there's two parts to that question that are equally important. One of them is, isn't it the responsibility of the public school to educate the parent? Even as early as kindergarten, parents come in to meet the kindergarten teacher. And this is pre-COVID. To learn, what are your children going to be experiencing this year in kindergarten? And we have PTA meetings, and we have all sorts of venues that are free and part of the public school system. So my feeling is that the reason we're still having trouble getting the word out is that a lot of those meetings, whether they're done in a Zoom format or they're done sitting in that kindergarten classroom, I mean, because it really could be either way, really need to be meaty. like they really need to be teaching parents what is the science of reading? And equally important, what is the science behind teaching math? Right. You know, we're not doing so great in STEM either. Like, you know, we're not the only ones who have problems, you know, in terms of getting the word out of what is just fun and cute or natural, you know, what just comes to your mind, like, gee, how did I learn how to read? I don't know. It's been a long time ago, you know, to really giving parents tools, because parents are your first and your forever teachers. Whether you are a homeschool parent or your kid is in public school, parochial school, Montessori, whatever, wherever they are, the parents remain your teachers in so many ways. So I think part of the problem is a lack of emphasis on training parents. Mm-hmm. The second part of that problem is teachers are not always being taught the science of reading in their undergraduate and graduate programs.
And I can interject here, if I may. I was one of those teachers. I graduated from a prestigious school with a master's degree in elementary education. So one would think that I had been taught how to teach reading, but I had not. I thought I had. So I was taught with a very whole language approach and the whole idea that kids learn to read sort of by osmosis and exposure to books. And I love literature, so this all sounded great. And then, boom, I hit the real world. And it's like not everybody just picks up reading from the air. Right. So there's a great, great disservice done to teachers who are in schools of education by holding on to these antiquated ideas that, while idealistic and pretty, aren't following science. And so until these schools change the way they're teaching these teachers, then the school systems aren't going to be as effective. We're fortunate in Maryland that we've had many champions of the science of reading, and that recently laws have been passed to change the kinds of testing that teachers who are going to teach in this state need to pass in order to teach students how to read. So as the teacher testing is changing, then the schools, the universities, are going to be forced to teach the upcoming teachers the content that they're going to be seeing in these teacher exams, which will then ultimately benefit the students who are receiving, you know, the education, who are sitting in their classrooms.
Yeah, if you don't pass a test showing you understand the science of reading in Maryland, by the way, this is only as of July 2019, okay? It took us 15 years on Right to Read Maryland to finally get this done, because if you don't pass that test, you cannot become certified to teach in Maryland. And we had so much pushback on that from every subgroup you could imagine. And yet, other fields have high standards. You can't just become a dental hygienist without getting a license. This is not unique to have to pass a test, but boy, is that going to change things, because any college that doesn't include that in their curriculum now, they're going to have teachers who can't get jobs. So that's right. Pretty serious. And so the colleges really fought us in a big way, but it got passed. And we also passed an early intervention law that ensured that every kindergarten child at the beginning of kindergarten would be tested to see if they were at risk for a reading problem. So that was also the same year, 2019, that got passed.
Right.
That was a here in Maryland. But back to your original question, so half of the problem is we have school systems not really teaching parents how to be teachers at home. Some do, right, but it's not ubiquitous by any means. And then we have teachers who don't understand, because they're not making teachers already in service do all of this. This was for new teachers, right? So that's half the problem. The other half is an interesting thing, as you brought up during COVID and, you know, access to information and how do you choose? I think there's a good and a bad thing happening there. I think with all the podcasts and YouTubes and video demonstrations that are on all kinds of sites, parents actually have greater access because of all these vehicles. The hard part is, are they good at discriminating? Which is something that just, as Stephanie used the term before, looks pretty versus something that really works. And I think that if those two things could come together, if we really had a really sincere effort to educate our teachers and educate our parents and made that a priority, unlike what it is now, in some schools that I go into for various reasons, I go to schools all over the place, and like some of them are amazing. I mean, they have just pulled the parents in and they're part of decision making. And then other places, literally, they don't feel welcome. I mean, parents have said to me, I feel like when I come in, I'm the parent who sat at a meeting and asked for things for my child that nobody wanted to give. So they don't like me anymore. You know, this almost this clash between my child as a parent and your child as the student in your school. So I think one of the things that's going to change all of this is that early intervention piece. You said something before where you said, if your child's starting to have trouble, you know, then you say, wait a minute, what do I do? Right. We're now trying to do a prevention model where we look at you at the beginning of kindergarten or pre-K in some schools where that exists and say, you know what, who's at risk? Because some kids might be at risk in a very, very profound way. And we know that child's going to fail. So we're going to try and make sure that they never fail, that we intervene really early. There'll be other kids who, while they were being given the test, they were under the table, you know, and the tester, I am a diagnostician, you know, by profession as well. And I mean, I know some kids where I think, I don't know if one thing I found matters because the kid was, you know, running around the room, getting the kid back to the table. But if that's the case, I got to keep working to get that kid to the table, because we now can predict dyslexia. And that's huge. If we can figure out, because children who have a family history of dyslexia, it is genetic, and also have difficulty with phonological awareness and early reading interventions, and also 40% of kids with dyslexia also have ADHD. Now, not everybody with ADHD has dyslexia. That doesn't work in reverse. You have a kid sitting there whose mother had trouble learning how to read, and the kid's really not picking anything up in class and can't clap out the syllables in elephant, which you should be able to do at age 3. Like, if we have all this information on the table and the child has ADHD, we just need to intervene. Because what's the worst that comes out of intervening? You learn how to read. So maybe this was milder than we thought, and the kid was developmentally young in some ways, but really, we know what to do. And so when it's not unlike medicine, you don't wait for the heart attack anymore. Right, you know, right. You yeah. say, God, really at risk. You know, I had 2 parents with heart disease, right. And my cholesterol's high and my blood pressure is through the roof. I think I'm going to treat those things and maybe never have the heart attack. And okay. That, I think, is going to take care of a lot of this, because then we'll be talking to the parent early and getting parents to say, well, I never knew it mattered whether a kid could clap out the syllables in elephant, but okay, I'll work on that, you know, and we have all kinds of strategies and games and things like that.
Yeah. And I think though that's amazing that you've done that work and you're helping schools get to that point. I would love to get your thoughts on, because you obviously have a ton of experience helping push school systems and even the whole state of Maryland forward by fighting for the rights of students. And I think there's so many schools and so many families, kind of like on the podcast that you have on your website, that describes how hard it is sometimes for parents to get the service that they deserve for their kids in terms of the special curriculum, the special education that they have the right to. And I would love to get your insights on how did you go about fighting for student rights when so often in my experience in public schools and private schools, a lot of the decisions are made for the school to make things easier for the school, to make sure they're not going to be falling into any legal trouble. A lot of the decisions are made, okay, let's just make sure we cover our own rear ends first. And then if we have enough on the excess, then we can start helping students. What you fought for is, hey, let's put the students first. Let's get over these challenges. Let's push colleges. Let's push people who are educating our teachers to do the right thing. How does a parent who isn't in Maryland, who doesn't have a school that's doing early diagnosis, who is like hearing about this stuff for the first time on this podcast, how do they fight for what they deserve? How do they push to get their kids tested? How do they push to get the proper teaching in their child's classroom? What do you recommend to someone who wants to fight for their kids and fight for the best education that they deserve?
Well, finally, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of people that are part of this movement now. And I think the biggest thing was now 50 states have decoding dyslexia chapters, which is a bunch of parents who said, we are not gonna keep going through this stuff year after year where we beg for our children to get help. Mm-hmm. And I think decoding dyslexia is responsible for the laws that have been passed in all 50 states. Now, there are still 4 states where the laws are kind of loose, super loose. And some states, the laws are really, really intense. Mm-hmm. So you see these differences based on a lot of times who the governor is. Like the current governor of California is dyslexic. Well, hey, it's a priority in that state to get the best laws possible. And that happened in Connecticut, where the governor was dyslexic. But I think these decoding dyslexia groups have made a tremendous difference. They're free, they're accessible to every parent, and they're local. You know that expression, all politics are local? That's kind of how this is. Yeah. And like, I have a school district that I'm working in where I've now trained 665 teachers in that school district in Orton-Gillingham in a full out 60-hour course. So it's not just 6 hours, it's 60 hours. They're really getting a lot of training. And that course exists because parents from Decoding Dyslexia just kept going back saying, we have to do this. We are not, even if their own children failed, you know, they want to prevent this from continuing to happen. Now that same school district is doing a pilot on 500 of the students with OGSTAR to say, okay, what happens if you also put in reinforcement? That same school district is sending professionals, Stephanie is one of them, into the classroom to be with the teachers for 3 hours to say, okay, show me your hardest case. Show me what kid you're having trouble with, and we will work on this. And we don't use that information to evaluate the teacher because we want the teacher to be open and feel free that they can ask questions and they're not going to get some evaluation like they did a good or bad job. That's not the point of it, you know? And that was really a hard selling point because school districts are used to evaluating everything. Right. You know, everything is being measured. But so you see that there are ways of getting these things into public schools, but it's the parents. As a professional, I am not a parent of a dyslexic child, but as a professional in the field working on this for decades, we just could only get so far. it had to be the people who were experiencing the pain, because where there's pain, there's passion.
Right.
And I'll tell you, I have never seen anything like the Decoding Dyslexia movement. Now, that explains what to do for the kids who are dyslexic, but there are a lot of other kids who need to have the science of reading in their classrooms. Some school districts are choosing methods that are still whole word guided reading, and they call them balanced literacy. Boy, that sounds so good, balance. Who doesn't want balance in their lives, right? Except that balanced literacy basically is whole language that discovered whole language was no longer a good word to use. So they sprinkled in a little phonics, and they sprinkled in a little bit of this and a little bit of that. It's still basically whole word teaching and whole language. People get taken in by that term, and that's really frustrating.
Right.
Because structured literacy is the science of reading. Balanced literacy is not. And right. So what they do is the kids who can't do it, and there are plenty of them, because across the country, really only about 40% of the children in the United States are reading on grade level. I mean, we are not a third world country. We are a literate country. And to have so many children illiterate that they can't read at grade level, it's just unacceptable.
Yeah, thank you for that background. And I'm hoping, like, if through this podcast, we're giving parents more tools and more ideas on what they can do to help their kids. I'm curious, I was born in 1984. I grew up in the late 80s, early 90s. A lot of my friends who I grew up with are having kids who are at that point where their kids are in kindergarten, about to start reading. They're reaching out to me. One thing that I remember growing up was this, the program Hooked on Phonics worked for me. And obviously, So I'm just curious for listeners who are around the similar age as me and who are like, oh, well, this worked for me. What are my kids getting access to this Hooked on Phonics program? Can you talk a little bit about the differences between OGSTAR and your program and maybe something like Hooked on Phonics, just for people who are around my age and have kids about to start their reading journey?
It's an interesting question, because at the time that you grew up, that was when whole language was really seeping in. So a lot of programs sprung up to kind of say, hey, you know, just learning how to read in thin air works for about, and these numbers vary depending on what you're using to measure being a good reader, because there's lots of aspects to reading, but there's always going to be a top group. And that top group of readers, they're the kids who figured out the code on their own, just like in math.
Right.
There's always going to be that top group. I remember in my daughter's first grade classroom, there was a kid who was doing algebra in the first grade. He didn't need to be taught. He like figured it out, you know, and then he became a rocket scientist. So, you know, no real surprise there, really. But the fact is that a lot of programs for phonics training came to be because kids were not learning phonics.
Right.
Whole language just threw it all out. He said, no, reading is supposed to be fun and beautiful books and look at the pictures and, oh, you're going to get so excited because this is such a fun book.
Right.
Well, yeah, if you figured out the code, you can jump right into comprehension. And that's going to always be the case. There's always going to be that top group. And whether you're looking at that top group as 15% of your population or even as much as a third, it kind of is tied into socioeconomics, because some children who weren't exposed at all, you know, may not come in reading because they haven't had as much exposure, but they will very quickly figure it out because they got the code.
I was just going to add, it's like when a big difference that we see is with other programs when they say they're phonics-based and they teach a sound to the kids. So they teach the students that the letter M makes the sound, and they practice that. And then the teacher moves on and ask the class to contribute and let's talk about words that start with the sound mm or have mm in it. And the teacher's writing down on the board the word mom and mat and mother and mathematics and magician. And great. And then the kids are supposed to sort of put all that together and know all of these words. Well, they haven't learned any of the other sound components in most of those words. And so Orton Gillingham and Oxstar are safe programs in that what the children are expected to know, they have been directly taught. They're never introduced to a word that has components, sound bits in it that haven't directly been taught previously. And then they continue to practice those sounds for mastery and then build upon them. But we don't throw things at students that are just out there and haven't been explicitly explained. So that's a problem. A lot of other programs are not systematic and they jump around without a good reason for the sequence of what they're teaching.
Just to add to what Stephanie was saying, I think that programs popped up, lots of them, in addition to Hooked on Phonics, saying, hey, here's some, you know, phonics workbooks because you're not learning any of this stuff. And they moved to this sort of balanced literacy, and you were right in the thick of it.
Right.
Balanced literacy says, well, you use these three cues. If you can't figure out a word, look at the picture. And if you still can't figure out the word, well, think about the context. Like, what does it mean in a sentence, you know, and in that particular sentence? And then a third strategy is just look at the first sound, which is what Stephanie was talking about. And so basically it's teaching you how to guess. Well, if you sort of are already kind of phonologically aware or you have really lots of experience and good vocabulary, you can keep that up for quite a while. But like one day you're reading a physics textbook, you cannot guess by the picture. If you take something like the theory of relativity, you can't call it the theory of relatively.
Right.
You can't just decide to skip a syllable somewhere along the way. You know, so those guessing strategies don't work for kids in the middle group or the low group. Right. And by the way, when I say low group, I don't mean low intellectually. I mean low at figuring out the code.
And I think that's what a lot of parents know. Parents know. They talk to their kids. They know how smart their kids are. And they see the disconnect between what's happening when their kids are faced with print. And they can follow that instinct, you know. They're usually on target. And schools might say to them, no, your kid's fine, let's wait. You know, he's okay, she's okay. Well, let's give it some time, let them mature. But that's really the wrong approach. We don't want to wait. We want to attack these issues as early as possible.
Right. And why should parents have to be the ones asking for this should be coming from the school?
Right.
You know, it's so backwards. Yeah. And I think that what you were discussing earlier, Steve, is really at the root of it, that parents buy programs for their kids, go to the library with their kids, you know, do all kinds of things to try and get their kids what they need.
Right.
But they shouldn't have to. I shouldn't have to go to the pediatrician and say, why are you not doing antibiotics? I hear they work well for strep throat. This is not how the world works. So this really affects children from impoverished communities even more because there are just so many other issues going on for those kids. You know, parents who are working two jobs, they can't get to the PTA meeting, and just, you know, so many issues. I have one school that I go into rather frequently where a certain percentage of their kids are homeless. And I've sat down and, you know, worked with these children myself, and oh my God, it just breaks my heart because I feel like I'm here to help you learn how to read, to get your teachers to be able to help you and to make sure, you know, we figure out if you're at risk. Well, that kid's already at such risk. So, you know, there's been a lot of research showing that the Annie E. Casey Foundation, for example, which is a research organization that looks a lot at education and poverty, and they discovered that if you couldn't read by the third grade and you were poor, there's a 4 times greater chance that you're going to drop out of high school.
Oh, wow.
And we all know that's never going to be a good thing.
Right.
So I think these things become even more pronounced when we look at children who are traumatized in some other way, and then you add this reading problem. In the past, though, there was almost like a reverse issue happening where people would say, oh, if you just feed that child, then he'll learn how to read. Well, we need to do both. I mean, that child needs to come to school to get fed, but it would be really good to be literate and fed.
Right.
It might actually break that cycle of poverty at some point if you become literate. So I think we're seeing this play out in different populations in different ways, you know. And the thing about OGSTAR is we're trying to make it available in public schools so it won't be an expense to the family, because if they use our Chromebook model, for example, they can do it in school and at home,
right?
If they have a device. And most school districts now, it's interesting, are really moving to that one device per child model. I think because they have to, you know, there's just so much. Classrooms are now using the internet and apps and different programs that it's almost becoming a necessity, but we're not quite there yet either. But we wanted it to be that children would have access to this for free through their school system. And that's what, you know, we're trying to do. And we're noticing there was one little school district in Pennsylvania where a kid started using the app, and this was a child in sixth grade who was not reading. And so the app then led to changing his IEP, taking out the whole language apps that they were using, putting in OGSTAR, and then the school system called and said, well, can we train our teachers? Why should this only be on an app?
Right.
So it's interesting, you know, it can be a stimulation for further help for children in places where really they weren't using the science of reading.
Thank you for that. I had one last question for both of you, in terms of something that I think may help out a lot of our parents who are listening. I have a 2-year-old, a 7-year-old, and a 9-year-old. And a lot of parents that have similar age kids always ask, well, what are the milestones that I should be looking out for? Like, what should my 5-year-old be able to do? What should my 8-year-old be able to do? And I've been trying to kind of gather that information for them. Obviously, everybody's going to be a little different. But do you have any recommendations for the parent who is, again, 2 parents that are working, haven't been able to keep up on the research or go to PTA meetings or anything like that? Do you have anything that are quick, bite-sized milestones that they may be able to just look out for so that they know if they should go get some additional help from a specialist or try to get some intervention work done? Do you have anything that we could give our parents in terms of those milestones?
Well, I think with the youngest kids, as we've been saying all along, that phonological awareness is something that they can really look out for when they're talking with their kids, when they're driving in the car. It's easy to play little games with your student, with your child, and say something like, say a couple of words and say, you know, Pat, Pam, are those words the same? You know, or are they different? Let's play the same or different game. Or tap, top, are those words exactly the same? You know, or to play little games like rhyming games and say, cat and hat, do those words rhyme? What about top and sit? Do those words rhyme? Let's read some rhyming words and, you know, let's expose them to rhyming words and see if they're able to discriminate between them. and to, you know, start to understand, you know, also be able to repeat the alphabet is something that, you know, students work on that I think is, Fran, is one of the pieces, correct?
It shows some sequential memory. And I think that, you know, looking at a child's memory span is important. The interesting thing is that a lot of parents will jump in and say, oh, now that you can say your alphabet, let's learn it on paper. And they use capital letters and they learn the letter name. So they say, this is the letter A, this is the letter B, whatever, and there might be some pictures that go with it. And that, taking it to that next step, is not very helpful.
Right.
Most words are not written in capitals, first of all.
Right.
And most words, you could say S-A-T, 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 over and over and over again, and you are not reading the word set.
Right, right.
But if that child learns sat, well, hey, you just speed that up a little bit and you got the word set.
Right.
So
right.
I think one of the things about this phonological awareness that Stephanie was just talking about that's so important is that most children by age 6 are phonologically aware. Age 6, it's part of natural human development of language. Taking sounds off, putting sounds in, blending sounds together, segmenting words apart, all without letters. So what I would recommend is that you literally Google phonological awareness. You will not believe how many thousands of checklists there are. Mm. And they're all doing the things that I was just talking about and that Stephanie was just using as examples. There are some formal tests. If a child is, and you can even, you know, when you look at a two-year-old, we have studies on babies. There's a wonderful book called Scientists in the Crib, where we actually look at babies and their phonological awareness, and we know we can work with babies and start to change their phonological awareness before they're even one. You just have to make sure that you get what's on those checklists. One of the formal tests that I like is called the phonological awareness test. But there are many, many formal and informal measures of phonological awareness. One of the interesting outcomes of OGSTAR that neither Stephanie nor I like remotely thought about till we were at a meeting at a large, very large school district. And we were doing the app with the supervisors of literacy to talk to them about looking at OGSTAR as an option for their students because they had really miserable scores, way lower than 40% reading on grade level. I believe it was 15% reading on grade level, which is just really bad.
Right.
But anyway, and we saw that some of the people who were the supervisors couldn't do the app. And we left and we said, a lot of them were dyslexic. Right. And you don't know, some people think, well, maybe I can make a difference for other children, like I made it, and who knows how they made it, you know, right. One way or another, because people with dyslexia are smart, capable people, they can do anything. But when it comes to saying to them, can you tell me box without the book? And they look at you like, what? But one of the things I would say to just take this point and elaborate on it in one other way that I think is really important. The app ends up training the parent in how to work with your child, even though that was never intended. I would have parents, and the same thing happened to Stephanie, call and say, well, I noticed when my child was doing the app that he was moving different colored stones on a path to represent all the sounds in a word. And you use, like, for example, if the word is yes, you're going to have three different colored stones because it's the sound for the first letter, second letter, and third letter are different. If you have a word like mom, the first stone and the last stone are the same color because they are the same sound. And that's all part of phonological awareness. And people would say things to us like, well, why couldn't I just do that with real stones or with different colored index cards or with Legos? And we'd be like, well, you can. Or we'd have like a little puppet, you know, who'd be counting syllables in a word. And people would say, well, we could just do that, right? Yeah, you could put your child's hand under their chin and feel how many times their chin drops. Right. So I think that the one thing is that when you do the app, you actually learn about phonological awareness, which was unintended, but nevertheless helpful. But I think there's so much out there on this, and you are absolutely right. If you don't even know what you're looking for, how do you know what games to play? How do you know when to play them? And the rule of thumb is, by age 6, every kid should be pretty phonologically aware. I'm not saying no mistakes, you know, we are human, but should be doing really well on all of those different tasks. And if they're not, they need to be taught how to do that, because in the science of reading, the first thing that has to be mastered is phonological awareness. The next thing is phonics. The next thing is oral fluency. So you can't get to the third step without having the first step completed.
Right.
And this is true for regular kids. So with your kids, and boy, you must be busy having 3 kids who are 9 and under. The fact is that all of them should be phonologically aware. And I'll test adults sometimes who can't do those tasks. Adult dyslexics who have never gotten help. And some of them, you know, have survived by hook or by crook, and some of them have not survived. Some of them are people who are struggling and they can't fill out a job application, or people who are good at, you know, being an electrical person, like an electrician, and they can't pass the test because they can't read the test properly. So phonological awareness doesn't just fix itself by getting older. It has to be specifically taught. So I think parents can do a lot of this at home, and they also need to convince their schools whenever they can to look at all of this research.
Right.
And it is out there. It's just hard to be selective, you know, and to bring it to the table.
That's amazing information. Thank you. That definitely helps me out as a parent, and I'm sure that will help a lot more people as well. And so thank you again. This was amazing. I could talk for hours and hours with both of you, but thank you for all of your amazing work and for putting together such an awesome app. And thank you for taking the time today to talk.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure, and I'm just so excited looking forward, because we are finally starting to really be heard. That National Reading Panel was the year 2000. It was 20 years ago. It's just kind of ridiculous that it moves so slowly, but we're making progress. And I really feel like the next 20 years, we're maybe going to do it like full out. You know?
Right.
That's the goal anyway.
Absolutely.
And I think it's great that you're out there getting this information to parents, both as an educator yourself and a parent, and in this new environment that we're in, I think there's so much that parents need to hear. And when you're bringing in various experts, I think that's so valuable to parents to sort of have one place to go to find out information about a variety of topics that they're thinking about. So,
and we wish you so much luck. Your startup.
Yeah. Thank you for listening to the Learning Pod Network. If you'd like more information about our offerings and services, please go to www.impactconnections.org. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at ImpactConnectED. We will also be releasing our weekly newsletter called Teaching Tuesday, every Tuesday, where you'll get a summary of all of our latest information and resources that we have found as we explore the best practices of learning pods and education during COVID-19. So thank you, and we hope you'll join us next week. Take care, be well, and teach together.